You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 7:30 and time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us this morning live in the studios Linda Beavis and Ed Mast, both Seattle residents who have been involved with Palestine-Israel issues for several years. Well, actually, I'm not sure for how long. Linda and Ed, thanks for joining us. And why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in these issues?
I traveled over there for the first time in 1995. I'm a playwright, actually, and was writing about some of the issues that are problems over there. I had Palestinian friends who began to make me inform myself of the truth about the injustices over there. Actually met Linda back here in Seattle working on a conference about Middle East issues sometime after that.
And I worked over in Palestine in Ramallah with a Palestinian human rights organization for a couple of years in the early 90s as a human rights lawyer. And since coming back, I've been involved with the Palestine Solidarity Committee and the Palestine Information Project and the Seattle International Human Rights Coalition.
All right, and my understanding is you were both just recently over in that region. Is that correct?
Yep, we were over there in August. We were working with the International Solidarity Movement to End the Occupation, which is a nonviolent Palestinian-organized campaign to resist the various injustices that they have to live with. And they've called for people from all over the world for international involvement in what's going on, so that Americans, and we were there with people from France and Italy and England and Colombia and various places, can participate in nonviolent actions and provide some human shield, some protection for Palestinians who want to protest nonviolently but are subject to such a high level of violence from the Israeli forces.
Yeah, I just have some statistics from the last year, which is what attracted us to go over there now. Two of the 3 million Palestinians living in the occupied territories are living under the poverty line. There's over 60% unemployment. 800 of their homes have been demolished. Over 700 Palestinians have now been killed, and over 100 Israelis. 59% of the Palestinians who've been killed were killed while they were going to work or going to school in no-clash situations. Another 36% were killed in nonviolent demonstrations or possibly stone-throwing against soldiers with tanks and guns. So most of the Palestinians who've been killed have been killed just trying to go about their daily lives or nonviolently protesting the occupation. The West Bank is now divided into over 100 separate parts because of all the closures that and checkpoints that the Palestinians have set up. So it's impossible just to get from home to school or home to visit family without having to go through an Israeli roadblock. 15,000 Palestinians have been injured, 10% of them with life-crippling injuries. So it's a really, really hard time for the Palestinians just to go about daily life, and that's why we were over there.
So can you give us an update? This has obviously been in the news a lot, although it's been getting, I think, on the back pages since September 11th to a greater or lesser degree. Can you give us an update on what's currently happening there?
Well, unfortunately, what's happening there has been happening for some time, since 1967. There have been several million Palestinians living under military occupation. State of Israel imposes martial law, which adds up to military dictatorship in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, the occupied territories. What that means is that Palestinians are not citizens of anywhere. They're subjects of this military occupation. They have no right to vote in elections for Israeli government. They have no freedom of speech, no freedom of assembly, no freedom of movement. They can be arrested and imprisoned without charge or trial. They can be held up to 6 months. It's called administrative detention, and then that can be renewed indefinitely. They are taxed by the Israeli government, for which they cannot vote, so they're subject to taxation without representation. And there's no equal use of resources. 80% of the water in the West Bank goes to 10% of the population, the Israeli settlers that are moved into the zone, and leaving 90% of the population, Palestinians, to divide up 20% of the water. And so we have Palestinians carrying water in buckets and living next to Israeli settlements with swimming pools and golf courses. And the settlements themselves are a problem.
Yeah, under international law, the Fourth Geneva Convention says very clearly that if you're occupying a territory, you should not bring your population into the territory. You shouldn't transfer populations in, nor should you transfer populations out. And both of these are happening. There are over 350,000 settlers right now living in the occupied territories in over 400 towns. They look like lovely condominium towns with their swimming pools. And also some Palestinians have been expelled from the occupied territories, both when Israel occupied the West Bank in 1967, when over 250,000 Palestinians were expelled, and also over the years, some of them have been deported. And of course, many of them are forced to leave because the economic situation is so bad they cannot find any livelihood there.
All the settlements, of course, are built on confiscated Palestinian land. So not only are Palestinians living under apartheid conditions, I used to say apartheid-like conditions, like the conditions in old South Africa when the white minority imposed apartheid on the black majority. Now, activists from South Africa are observing that situations for Palestinians are worse in many ways than they were in old South Africa. For example, one of the infamous laws in old South Africa was that you could be held without charge for 90 days. Well, in Palestine, you can be held for 6 months, and then that can be renewed. That's one example. So Palestinians are living under appalling circumstances, and their land can be confiscated. Their houses can be knocked down. They can be driven out of the country. Over the past year, we've seen particularly an increase in olive tree orchards being bulldozed olive trees being one of the main industries and sort of national and ethnic symbols as well for the Palestinians. An olive tree can take 100 years to grow and to reach fruition, and so to bulldoze down a grove of them is another example of the state terrorism that Israel is applying to try to force the Palestinians to submitting to the military dictatorship.
Something that a lot of people don't realize is with the settlers, the Jewish-Israeli settlers living in the occupied territories, often right next door to Palestinian towns, that the settlers are subject to totally different laws. They're subject to Israeli laws. If a settler throws a stone, that settler gets perhaps taken into an Israeli civil court and perhaps fined, although this hardly ever happens. If a Palestinian right next door throws the same stone, lands at the same place, that Palestinian will be almost definitely brought into Israeli military court and probably sentenced to some sort of prison sentence or just administratively detained for 6 months, as Ed was talking about. And when they're administratively detained, 97% of them are tortured. In 1997, the UN actually found that Israel had violated the Convention Against Torture and was routinely doing this to Palestinians. So the settlers are subject to totally different laws. They are allowed to walk around armed, and they will often, when the Israeli army says that a Palestinian town is under curfew, the Israeli settlers will then come out during curfew time, because they're not subject to the curfew, and they will shoot into houses, they will shoot into cars, they'll shoot out solar panels that used for heating water, they'll shoot out water tanks so that the Palestinians don't have any water. When I was living in the occupied territories, we would wake up sometimes at 5 in the morning to gunshots, with the Israeli settlers outside shooting all over the place, building roadblocks so that cars wouldn't be able to get to their work that day. The settlers are, one would say that they're a maverick population, except that the Israeli army stands by and watches them as they do these things, and the army will not, in most cases, come in and stop them. So there's a lot of collusion with the Israeli government.
Really, settlements are colonial outposts. What they should look like is Fort Apaches and places with pointy, made of pointy logs and with walls around them. What in fact they look like are condo developments out near Issaquah and so forth, except they have electric fences. The state of mind of the settlers is very similar to the pioneers in the American West. They see themselves as bringing a kind of civilization to a savage land, and they're in living in the wilderness surrounded by bloodthirsty savages that want nothing better than to cut their throats and savage them in various ways, and see themselves driven by a kind of manifest destiny. Again, very similar to the history of American colonization, and with similar genocidal bloody results.
And in fact, I believe there many of them are carrying weapons as well, similar to our settlers.
Commonly.
Yes.
Commonly.
Yes. And many of them are made in the United States. Many of them are M16s. Many of them are in the reserve of the Israeli army. Israel is a very militarized state. Every Israeli citizen is supposed to serve 3 years if you're a man, or 2 years if you're a woman, right after high school. They have high school classes that get them ready for the army. And then they're expected to serve a month every year after that. So a lot of the Israeli settlers are in the army routinely once a year, and therefore are armed with the same weapons that the Israeli army is armed with. And of course, the U.S. has a very close relationship with Israel, in which we sell them a lot of our weapons, Apache helicopters, F-16 planes, M-16 weapons. When we were in prison this summer, which we'll talk about a little later, I guess, we were handcuffed with Smith & Wesson handcuffs. And this is part of why Israel and the United States work closely together, because Israel is willing to test a lot of the weapons that we sell it. And often Israel tests those on Palestinians.
Also important to note about the settlers, that many of them are armed, and there are we had various levels of things that we could be afraid of when we were over there protesting. Of course, we're concerned about the Israeli army, about the Israeli police forces. They have various levels of sort of malice that they do, but most of them we could depend on to act like a military force. And whatever their rules of engagement were, we could disagree, we could deplore, we could mostly count on them to observe them, just as we would interact with our police here. The settlers, on the other hand, were the loose cannons. The settlers are the ones, by comparison, who will shoot sometimes, even if it makes no sense whatsoever. And so they were the ones that we were more afraid of. Now, we need to remember that many Israelis also deplore the actions, many of the actions that their government takes. Many Israelis deplore the occupation, deplore the apartheid that Palestinians live under. Many of them deplore the settlements and the settlers. You'll hear many Israelis describe the settlers as the loonies, the nuts that make us all bad. That's not even actually true of the settlers. Many of the settlers are religiously driven or ideologically driven to take land for the greater Jewish state and so forth, or driven by religious reasons. But many settlers have moved into these territories because of the subsidizing of homes by the Israeli government. So some of them just want to sort of start a family, get a little start in life, and there's a financial possibility out there, and really have no none of that pioneer ethic at all, but find themselves in a place, gee, I just wanted a break on a house, and I'm surrounded by people that want to kill me. And so then they start to develop that pioneer ethic, unfortunately, because they've been insulated from the causes of the injustice in which they're participating.
Mm-hmm. I just want to make it clear that although we did focus on the settlers for a while, it is the Israeli government and the Israeli army that is continuing to occupy the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and has continued since 1967, despite numerous UN Security Council resolutions calling, like 242, calling on Israel to withdraw. The entire world, other than the U.S., has condemned this occupation. It is illegal under international law to acquire territory by force, or to keep an occupation going this long. It's the longest modern-day occupation. And so really it is up to the Israeli government and the Israeli army to withdraw. And when they withdraw from the occupied territories, they're going to need to withdraw the settlements also, unless the settlers agree to live under Palestinian law in a Palestinian state and agree to not carry arms any more than Palestinians can carry arms.
Can you give us a brief history of the region, how all this kind of came to be?
Sure. Summing up a huge amount of history in a few strokes. Two or three important points. One is that both Palestinians and Jews have lived there in effect forever. Palestinians, today's Jews date themselves back to the ancient Israelites and Hebrews. Palestinians date themselves back to the ancient Canaanu, the Canaanites. Each of them have sometimes been the majority, sometimes been the minority, but both have an ancient continuous presence in the region. There's all kinds of complicated history. The couple of important points to know are that the country was called, that region was called Palestine until, from at least Roman times up until 1948. There was a war in which the new Jewish state conquered about 78% of it, and that became the nation of Israel. And we now call it, sometimes to distinguish it, we call it Israel proper, or Israel 48. Because in 1967, there was another war in which the state of Israel conquered the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So again, that's moving over all sorts of historical facts as well. The key element about that is that in the war of 1948, about 800,000 Palestinians were driven out of their homes, 418 villages destroyed. And that was the birth of the refugee problem, which we also hear about. Many of those are still alive. Many of those Palestinians still alive and their children and grandchildren living in refugee camps in Lebanon and Syria and Jordan and some still in the West Bank and in Gaza. In 1967, 300,000 more driven out. More refugees, more refugee camps, more children and grandchildren of refugees. However, many Palestinians in 1948 stayed. They and their descendants make up about 1 million Palestinians inside the state of Israel. Now, those Palestinians are citizens of the state of Israel. They're subject to a variety of discriminations, but they are allowed to vote in Israeli elections. They do have some fundamental human rights, even though they are second or in some ways third class citizens. However, in 1967, when Israel conquered the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, those were never annexed to become part of the state of Israel. Some of the regions around Jerusalem were annexed legally or not by international law. As a result, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have remained occupied territories. And again, this is not really legal by international law either, but since 1967, for 34 years and counting, those several million Palestinians, about between 3 and 4 million Palestinians now in the occupied territories, are, as we've said, not citizens of anywhere. They are subjects of this military occupation and thus are denied those basic human rights that we associate with citizenship. And that's why there are all kinds of injustices in Israeli society. There are all kinds of problems. And ultimately, it's my feeling, I think Linda shares this with me, that all the peoples in the region are going to have to learn to live together and work through all the problems that any society has. But this military occupation that has lasted since 1967 is the most outrageous of the injustices, and that's got to stop. That has to be, that apartheid has to stop before the difficult work of learning to live together can begin. It's the most extreme, and so it has to end the quickest.
Mm-hmm. I'll just add a couple of points. Ed was mentioning that Jews and Palestinian Muslims and Christians all lived together in the area for a very long time. And indeed, when you start talking to people who've been in the area for a long time, They will tell you that they lived next door to each other, that they shared each other's holidays, that they shared each other's food. There really were good relations, better relations between Jews and Palestinians in that area than between Jews and many Europeans in Europe. And indeed, for hundreds of years, and indeed it was a European movement of Jews to come to Palestine and to create a nation state there. It was a colonial movement from Europe that really brought on this this apartheid, this situation where some people have many more rights than others, situation where some people are citizens and others are not. So again, my feeling is that if the injustices are removed, that Palestinians and Jews could live together just fine in the region if they were all on the same equal footing. I'll just mention that although Palestinians have many more rights if they're citizens of Israel than the Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, there is a lot of institutional discrimination against Palestinians in Israeli society. If you have not served in the army, and Palestinians are not allowed to serve in the army, then you cannot pursue many careers that most people choose. You can't get subsidized housing. There are many rights that you don't have. And I was just reading, I think yesterday, that Azmi Bashara, who's, as far as I know, the one Palestinian representative in the Israeli parliament, he's a Palestinian Israeli, they are trying to strip him of his immunity because he has made statements to the effect that Palestinians deserve a nation state of their own. And so even some of the rights the Palestinians have are very much in danger of being taken away at any time. And the occupation of, or the annexation of East Jerusalem, that's my last point, is clearly illegal. You are not supposed to annex property that you have won by war. So it's an illegal annexation, but Israel has done it anyway.
It is real important. Linda's point is well taken for us all to remember that the conflict there is not a religious conflict. It's not an ancient ethnic grudge. It is the result of what amounts to a colonial movement from Europe. And when the injustice and the inequality in that region ends, then most of the conflict will end.
Weren't there peace talks recently tried to solve all this?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. I was over there living in Ramallah in 1993 when the Oslo peace process was announced to the world. It was a very secretive peace process that had gone on between Israel and Palestine with the U.S. Actually out of that loop a little bit, but then it got on board and there was a handshake on the White House lawn and everything was supposed to be moving towards a Palestinian state, with Palestinian autonomy being given. Nobody quite knew what autonomy meant, and it became clear in the next few years that, different folks had different ideas about what was supposed to go on. Palestinians thought that they were going to get more and more independence moving towards a nation state. So did a lot of Israelis think that. What actually happened, what the Israeli government, being the strongest power in the area, actually did was to say that the Palestinians were getting more autonomy. But actually, what the Israeli government did was subcontract the occupation to a Palestinian government. Yasser Arafat came back. There was a Palestine National Authority. And so all of a sudden, Palestinians in the big cities of the West Bank and Gaza Strip got to handle their own garbage pickup, their own education, which was a good thing. They did get to collect their own taxes. Palestinians still pay taxes to Israel, but via sales tax, not via income tax. Meanwhile, the Israeli government maintained the right to enter any Palestinian town at any time, so in other words, the occupation continued. And it also reserved the right to veto any Palestinian law that was passed by the new Palestinian parliament. So in effect, Israel still maintained all the rights to force and all the rights to government that it had had during all the other phases of the occupation. So the occupation has continued. Israel only allowed that little subcontracting of the occupation in a few towns, and those towns were always non-contiguous. And so in between each of those towns were all sorts of Israeli checkpoints and army, life in the occupation went on as usual. All of the difficult points of creating a Palestinian state were left until later in 1993. So should the Palestinian refugees be allowed back in or be compensated as a UN resolution calls for? What should happen with water? How should the settlers be removed as they were in the Sinai when Israel withdrew from Egypt? Or would the settlers stay? What would the exact borders be? What would happen to Jerusalem? How could that be shared? All of those issues were left until later. It was supposed to be a 5-year process, so 1998. That got postponed a little bit. And then when we got into the difficult negotiations of 1998, 99, 2000, things broke down. Because in the meantime, Israel had continued to build settlements, had continued to attract settlers to the occupied territories, had continued to confiscate land to build these huge highways. They call them bypass roads, but they are the width of football fields, and only Jewish Israelis can drive on them. And they crisscross the occupied territories, and they divide it up into all these little tiny Bantustan, cantons, reservations, in which the Palestinians are being pushed and ghettoized. And so the eventually, I think the process came to a head, and people realized that, oh, there's a huge conflict in what Israel means by some sort of Palestinian autonomy and by what Palestinians would like for a nation state. The last talks happened in 2000, and Prime Minister Barak made an offer, and it has been widely called a generous offer, which is not true. And the media has visited both on the Israeli people and the Americans a large whitewash of what the situation actually was.
A big lie.
Yes. Barak offered 95% of 65% of the West Bank, which is in turn 23% of historic Palestine. He said that Israel needed to still maintain a buffer zone around the entire West Bank and Gaza Strip so that Palestinians would not have a border with any other country but Israel. Israel could decide who could come in and who could leave. Jerusalem was still to be controlled by Israel, although there were going to be some religious sites that were offered to the Palestinians. And Palestinians would still be living in non-contiguous areas. The towns wouldn't be joined up. Do you want to add to that, Ed?
Just in effect that it was the same offer that was made before. Barak's generous offer was another version of Palestinians living on reservations with no fundamental independence, but being maintained as a cheap labor force for Israeli society with no genuine sense of self-determination. Israeli society, many Israelis are believing that these generous offers were made and the Palestinians turned them down, and therefore the Palestinians don't want peace, when in fact they were not generous offers at all. They were the same old nonsense, and that's why they broke down. And thus, the current year-long round of particular violence began on September 29th, a Friday of the year 2000, when the Israeli army fired live ammunition into an unarmed crowd of Palestinians, killed 4 of them. And that was the spark that lit the fire that was already smoldering because of the injustice that Israel insisted on maintaining.
Well, we've only got about 2 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about some of the events and activities that you've been participating in and going to be holding here in the near future.
If you care about this issue of injustice, then come on out next Saturday, November 17th, down to Westlake Center, Saturday, noon o'clock to 2 o'clock. We do a sidewalk teach-in, we call it, a vigil, a protest. We hold signs, we hand out leaflets, we have conversations with people. It's pretty non-threatening. We just want to try to get the word out that the occupation must end. And we're doing it bi-weekly, every 2 weeks. And so the next one will be November 17th, Westlake Center at noon o'clock.
You can also get in touch with us at palestinejustice@yahoo.com.
And if you're got nothing better to do and care about justice generally today, not directly on the issue of Palestine, we We've also been working with the 911 Peace Coalition locally, and come down to Victor Steinbrook Park down by the public market at noon today in a vigil for Afghanistan for the people there to try to stop the bombing and get food aid in so that millions of them do not starve.
All right, and one more time, that email address, and is there a phone number or a snail mail address, since a lot of people still aren't connected to the internet?
PalestineJustice@yahoo.com, 206-633-1086.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having us, Mike.
Thank you.
Just been talking with Linda Beavis and Ed Mast, who are both local Seattleites and amongst other organizations they're with, the Palestine Information Project.